Hello, and welcome to the Mobility Podcast. Thank you for tuning in. This is Greg Rogers. It's been an eventful year, to say the least, but we're getting back in the swing of things here, and we'll have some more episodes coming out very soon. I just want to note that this episode was recorded way back in May 2020, around the time when dinosaurs roamed the earth, but the themes and the topics that we discussed were timeless. How do we create a mobility ecosystem that serves everyone? How do we address the negative public health and public safety outcomes? How do we reduce traffic deaths and injuries? How do we tackle the challenge of transportation being the number one contributor to emissions? And how do we increase access to job opportunities rather than having transportation act as a barrier in many ways? So thank you for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy the episode. All right. Hello and welcome to the Mobility Podcast. This is Greg Rogers, and I'm joined by my lovely, handsome co-host. You know who it is.
Which one?
Pete.
Oh, sorry. Pete Gould with Catapult Policy Strategies.
And my equally handsome co-host.
This is Greg Rodriguez. And as always, views are our own. Haven't said that in a while. Feels good.
Excellent. Well, as always, we appreciate everyone tuning in, especially during this challenging time when there's a lot of shifts in the mobility industry, and there's certainly no lack of issues to discuss. And on that note, we are joined by Kyle Rowe, who is the head of government partnerships at Spin, for this episode. So, Kyle, welcome. It's great to have you on.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me. Really looking forward to our discussion.
Great. Well, let's jump right into it. So, you know, the term micromobility is thrown out a lot. So let's just level set. How do you and how does Spin perceive micromobility? What is micromobility to you?
Yeah, it's not something not discussed as much as I thought it would be. I see micromobility as just the acknowledgement that the types of two-wheeled devices, the different form factors that we're seeing enter the bike lane and offer folks a different way to get around encourages the mode split that we want to see. It's basically the acknowledgement that that is not just the bicycle as we knew it in the past, and that the different adaptations of it, everything from, you know, an e-bike that actually is more like a cruiser and that it's throttle based down to like a one wheel, even an electric skateboard, all of these things, these devices are welcome in the bike lane if they're encouraging folks to get around in a safe and environmentally friendly manner. So that's kind of my understanding of it, but I imagine that would change depending on who you ask.
That's great. And it's Pete. So obviously this is, it feels like these scooters have been around for a while, but it's we're talking about a several year old industry. And with that, cities have had to quickly adapt and first create and now iterate on regulations. Can you talk a little bit about how you've seen the regulatory environment change in the time that you've been operating?
Yeah, certainly. So I think, item to just mention about that, to kind of help folks understand where my perspective comes from. So prior to being at Spin, I worked for the Seattle Department of Transportation for 5 years. Started on long range planning. So I did the GIS analysis for our bike master plan. That was kind of my entry into transportation out of college, was in geospatial analysis. Moved into corridor design. So I wanted to turn those lines on a map to curb channelization. And then that kind of led me into bike share. And at the time it was still station-based bike share business model was the playbook that every city was iterating. And we had one in Seattle called Pronto. So pretty much the same model as what Capital Bike Share in DC has, with very similar hardware and relationship between city and vendor and sponsor and all that. Because of some budget constraints and just political concerns over the viability of the program and its funding, we were forced to basically shut down our bike share system. So Seattle entered the summer of 2017 with no bike share system live, which, very, was very challenging for the safety and bike advocates in the community, because Seattle is supposed to be this progressive, you know, bubble out in the Pacific Northwest leading on these things, not the only major city in the U.S. without a system. So I was tasked with putting Pronto in a warehouse, working with Motivate, who was the operator at the time, now a part of Lyft, to basically decommission the system. And that put me now as the bike share program manager for the city of Seattle with no bike share system on the ground. And that didn't really sit well with how I saw my career going. So that, you know, at the same time, this business model that didn't require public subsidy, that didn't require infrastructure, and brought the, you know, the task of getting people on bikes into the hands of a more innovative and modern player with these new dockless bike share companies. This is really before the micromobility term had even really caught on. They were starting to enter the U.S. You know, we saw the big ones with Ofo and Mobike eyeing up the U.S., but then both Spin and Lime both raised their first rounds and were starting to eye up markets at the same exact time. So I actually handed Spin and Lime their first permits in the U.S. I went to the launch parties with the founders of both Spin and Lime in Seattle for their first systems. So the first permit to manage dockless mobility with multiple vendors, no public subsidy, no stations, no bike share stations required, and operating requirements that create a fair market for that environment, was a permit that I literally wrote from a blank piece of paper in Seattle with the support of my department leaders, as in a kind of an adventure into a new space, and one that we saw a huge opportunity to lead the way on from a policy standpoint. So when I, you know, share observations on how has the industry changed from a policy standpoint, well, I'm talking like the very early days when the business model and the environment we're working in today started, to, you know, the adaptations and iterations it's gone through to today. And I'd say, you know, high level observation, one trend we're seeing across the U.S. and even Europe that I think is a good trend, it's a responsible trend, is cities being able to retain the right to enforce operating requirements, have data sharing mechanisms that are, you know, safe from a privacy standpoint, and also have the ability to control the number of vendors and the number of vehicles on the ground. And that's just a ability that city DOTs never really had with previous disruptive mobility technologies, and that resulted in, you know, basically the cannibalization of public transit ridership, you know, thinking about the proliferation of rideshare services around the U.S. So you know, at a very high level, I think that was one area that I wrote into Seattle's permit from the start, and was not adopted by all cities. In fact, because of the way scooters enter the market with mostly a launch and ask for forgiveness model from a few of our competitors, we actually saw that it was pretty open permit. Anyone was welcome to come in, and then, you know, cities started to layer on things once they started to experience the challenges that came from that sort of market entry strategy. And now the, you know, city DOTs have really understood that they have the ability to control the system, and that with fewer vendors, each vendor can offer a higher quality service, and the end result is a better product for the city and the customer and the companies participating. So DC is, you know, a great example of that, them going from, you know, they probably were at 10 vendors at one point, down to choosing for four for their 2020 permit that we're still waiting to actually implement. But that decision was made late 2019.
I actually want to pick up on the, I didn't know that, you know, you had wrote one of the first permits, which I think is interesting. So I think you already touched on one thing that I'm very interested in from a policy standpoint, a data sharing perspective. Did you have mm-hmm. data sharing requirements in that first permit? Or was that something that you didn't even get a chance to think about yet? I mean, look at where we are now, right?
We, I, I still look back at those glory days, and we had thought through a lot of this stuff. And it's funny, the environment we're working in today was very much envisioned. I had a great support in my team there. Evan Corey was my manager. Him and I started the new mobility team at SDOT. Evan wrote Seattle's new mobility playbook, which is, I think, probably the best city-led policy statement on how a DOT plays a role in various elements of new mobility. And then Scott Kubley was our director. Andrew Glass Hastings was our division director. All of these folks eventually went on to play roles in our sector. Both Evan and Scott worked at Lime, and Andrew worked at Remix for a while. So we had thought through all these issues. I mean, I'm not going to pretend like we had them all right, but for data sharing specifically, we had built a ecosystem where the vendors, which at the time was just Spin and Lime, and then a little bit later OFO joined, would share data with the University of Washington's Transportation Data Collaborative, or TDC. And they were basically a research arm within the University of Washington's transportation, their traffic engineering school had like a transportation research function. And they had gone to the state general counsel to basically get approval that because they're a research institution, they are a public agency, but because they're a research institution, they could store data and not be subject to a FOIA request. So basically the raw data that we are creating from the mobility providers would not be, you know, exposed to someone that maybe had a malicious intent for using that raw data, maybe, you know, re-identifying populations with the geolocation data. So that was the data sharing environment that we built. This is before MDS existed. This is before Remix or Populous or Ride Report were offering these data dashboards. So basically a team of researchers with support from Microsoft being a local player, doing some kind of like pro bono research support on how to visualize this data. We created a data sharing environment. There were a lot of kinks in the road in terms of how we executed the right sort of contracts and NDAs and all that. And mostly the SDOT kind of stayed out of it. And we just said, you just have to provide your data to University of Washington. But that same relationship where the city isn't ingesting this raw data was written into the first permit. And you can still find that permit on SDOT's website.
No, that's great. And that's really helpful background, especially for our guests. I do want to give, you know, a shout out to Jan Whittington and her team at the University of Washington. I've had the chance to work with her on privacy issues, and that was a great model. And, you know, you've already said it, but the city of Seattle has one of the most cutting edge privacy frameworks from a city perspective. So that's great that you were kind of at the forefront of all that and working on that. Maybe one other question on that front from the permit perspective is, how much did you think about public outreach? Because I know that's one thing that I've been really interested in, not only just from a safety perspective, but also an equity perspective. You know, how much public outreach were you able to do when you were launching that permit? And did you have people with pitchforks showing up at meetings saying, get these devices out of here, right?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's most certainly an important element of any public process. I experienced that the most when I was kind of the tip of the spear at SDOT, leading a lot of the really challenging protected bike lane projects. You know, taking like 130 parking spots off of Roosevelt Avenue through the University District to put in a protected bike lane through one of the main corridors that goes over a bridge, which, if you're familiar with Seattle's bike network, any bridge that you can get a bike lane on is pretty critical given that so many waterways. And you know, understanding how that worked, what was effective, when you informing this public versus asking for input from the public, it's a science and an art form of its own. With this specific project, we were faced with a challenge of how do we provide the public with a bike sharing option as fast as possible for the summer season, because Seattle being a rainy climate for so many months really has a pretty short window where if you are not able to launch the service, you're not going to be able to capture that time of the year when there's the most demand for these devices and these trips. So we did not nearly as much public outreach as I would have imagined for a typical like infrastructure project. I think we also weren't really quite aware of what public outreach looked like for new mobility policy yet, because to date, most new mobility kind of practices like this had happened to us. And this was one where we were the ones kind of leading the way and taking the initiative. So we wrote in equity distribution requirements into our permit. We also wrote in, basically rebalancing requirements. I basically took NACTO's station-based bike share guidelines, which was a document most cities were using for figuring out how to place stations and how dense of a network, because it was assumed you had to have stations, and extrapolated based on assumptions on number of docks and bikes from each station, how many devices made sense at a pretty solid saturation. Because one thing we knew about NACTO's guidelines is that they were very heavily influenced by the city bike implementation. So we were thinking, okay, well, if it's dense enough for Manhattan, it's certainly dense enough for, you know, all of Seattle and, you know, probably really just a framework to think about our downtown and center city. So use that as a way to extrapolate other policy documents that have been built for best practices and inform a really quick permit for Seattle. So had to get creative in how we gathered this sort of input to allow for a really quick launch. And then when I eventually went and joined Spin to kind of build upon this experience and hopefully represent that public sector ethos with a company that I thought was doing it the right way. And I know that when the next permit came around, the SDOT team there that's taken over the program did a much, much more robust public outreach process and gathered a lot of input, had a lot of forums, some of which Spin has participated in since. I think it wasn't a huge element of our initial implementation, mostly because of timeline.
That's great. And, speaking of uncharted territory, as we had discussed at the top of the show, micromobility is coming up as something that is discussed in the context of COVID-19. And on recent episodes, we've talked about the role of micromobility in helping people to get back to work. There are no best practices for this, right? We don't really have sort of lessons learned on how to return from a pandemic in the past, 50 plus years, right?
Yeah. No one's going to pay for this.
Yeah. I mean, if only we had thought of it. And so I'd be interested to hear from you. How is Spin thinking about this? How are you working with cities and how are you helping people to get around during this? And also thinking forward to, the gradual phased reopenings that we're going to see.
Yeah. This consumes our 9 to 5 right now, and in some weeks are 5 to 9. the benefit of micromobility, the benefits it can offer to a community that is trying to think about reopening their economy, to allow people to go back to work, to allow people to patronize businesses that, are more than a walking distance away, to visit friends and family again, the way that we just kind of restart public life without being able to rely on the backbone of our transportation network, our public transit systems, our bus systems, our light rail systems. That is a challenge that I don't know of any major city has faced and has a playbook sitting on the shelves ready to dust off. So, we certainly think about it in that way. And, we are my team at Spin, we are a lot of folks coming from transportation planning or transportation advocacy. So we're often putting ourselves in the city's shoes and trying to understand what they're trying to face and what they're trying to do to complement the reopening process. I think the fascinating example of this is is a decision the United Kingdom made to basically just take what was supposed to be four trials in 2021 to test scooters in parallel with a consultation on like vehicle code, safety best practices, because basically scooters are not legal in the vehicle code right now. And they said, hey, what, instead of four trials 2021, we're going to allow any city that wants to have a pilot do launch one starting in June, like next month. So they just fast tracked the whole legalization because they recognize that with the capacity that their transit systems could accept with social distancing practices is so reduced. I mean, TfL released a report saying they can move 15% of the people that normally move with the 100% of the headways that they would normally operate. And thinking about restarting London's economy with that reduced capacity of moving people, challenge them to say, well, how do we get people to move around? And so they just said, let's welcome scooters into the mix. So it's a combination of like quick action for cities that are thinking about their transportation network in that way, as well as deliberate partnerships that address issues specific to certain communities. So in a few cities, we're basically working with foundations to offer monthly rentals to healthcare workers so that they don't have to take the bus or take the shuttle that moves them around their hospital campus, or even use their own family vehicle so that they can just keep the vehicle they're touching when going to and from work every day, separate from the vehicle their family might be using. So that's, we have multiple partnerships that will be hopefully launching soon of that exact framework. In addition to just monthly rentals for customers. So this is, basically saying, well, why don't we just offer that to the public at large that in the markets we operate? If they prefer that service and they don't have to share it with another person. There's a variety of ways that we're trying to address it, but I think that's kind of what comes to mind immediately.
That's great. And, one of the things that we discussed in previous episodes too is that, SAFE recently released a report called Get America Moving Again, GAMMA. And we were really looking at, how can we get people back to work safely and help them get around safely? And, it seems like micromobility is such a great opportunity to do this because you have an unenclosed environment. You can easily sanitize the vehicles. I know that we're not epidemiologists here, but, the understanding is that, COVID-19 is way less likely to be transferred for something that is outdoors that is sanitized to protect the sun, right? I mean,
yes. We have been chatting with epidemiologists about this. We had the same questions. We were like, we need to make sure that how we see this is consistent. And that what you said, basically the fact that it's outside and your touch point is limited to the handlebars makes it about as safe as you could make it for transportation options right now.
Yeah, and even the most highly utilized of these devices, you're talking max four other people that might have touched it, right?
Yeah. In normal circumstances, you could have more than the average could be four trips per day, but one vehicle could have more. Right now, trip volumes are down significantly, less people are touching them. But what's interesting is that trips are a lot longer. We're seeing, we mapped recently the top 500 origin destination combos dissolved to census block pre and post COVID in a few cities to basically say, like, okay, if you just kind of take a city, chop it up into census blocks and draw lines between the most commonly combined origin of destinations, look at that pre and post COVID. You just see these massive shifts from the downtown and tourist centers to the neighborhoods, and the distances are much longer. And so we're seeing folks, while they're being used at less volume, new use cases, new trip trends are emerging that I think you know, we're kind of seeing folks become tourists in their own city. And because we can't travel, folks are finding ways to, you know, spend their weekends and enjoy this nice weather that we're all having in spring. I'm not sure what it's like in DC today, but I actually can't see a cloud right now out my window. And that's pretty rare in Seattle. You know, folks are getting around in new ways just within their own neighborhoods. And those, the average trip length for us has gone up about 40%.
So do you think there's I assume the answer is yes, a correlation between people feeling safer on the roads, there being less traffic. And obviously I'm really curious to see what happens if those numbers go down, or if all, you know, the movement towards biking, which is really exciting to see, if that unfortunately goes down as, I hate to say it, but the road rage returns. I mean, we're already seeing all the pictures of congested streets. And I know in Seattle, I was really excited to see Seattle Department of Transportation. You know, we talked about in the last episode, you know, taking steps to make some of the healthy streets or safe streets permanent. I guess the question for you is, are you using this as an opportunity to educate lawmakers on, you know, safer streets and using, you know, more spatial awareness to provide more opportunities for e-bikes, e-scooters, you know, to have a safer space to operate?
Yes. So a lot to unpack there. And a lot of this is going to come from my past life turning from a transportation planner into what I call a plan engineer, which is just like basically learning enough about street channelization and right of way to be dangerous, with a curb to curb design and, you know, if any way possible to get a bike lane in. The news about Seattle. So while I'm very excited about that, one of the projects is, three blocks from my house. And I enjoy walking down it, and I have experienced the reduction in traffic on that street. 200K for 20 miles of streets that are going to be closed to, you know, almost all traffic. What that means, just from knowing how much budget it takes to really make substantive changes to facilities, like hard infrastructure facilities, what that really means is signage. So we haven't seen the actual implementation plan for this yet, but what I expect is going to be is that there's going to be more signage about those streets being closed to only users that either live or need to access those, the parcels on the street. Now, that's still a good policy change. That policy change is in the favor of other modes using that street more liberally. These corridors were already neighborhood greenways for Seattle. Neighborhood greenway is a facility type that is basically a adaptation of a non-arterial to further enhance the safety for people walking and biking. And what we're really talking about is a policy change that reflects how the street should be operating to prioritize ped and bikes. That is an enhancement in the policy realm, but not really the physical realm on, an existing facility. So my hope, for the Seattle Bike Network is that we continue to upgrade these corridors, these neighbor greenways, in the way that was announced recently, but also continue with new facilities, projects that, you know, missing links in our network, because there are a ton, and not forget about the arterials, where physical separation from cars is necessary for all ages and abilities to feel safe, and that we, you know, we don't just check the box by having this announcement about upgrades to these 20 miles. But enough about Seattle. There's certainly an opportunity, and I have heard from folks, actually someone I work with consistently that lives in DC. She shared that she recently got back on a bike for a long time and was enjoying how calm the streets are. And I think it is an opportunity to, you know, have folks try the new mode and feel safer. One thing that is a challenge with reduced traffic is also increased speeds. So traffic is a natural friction with speeds that people will, you know, especially in urban environments, can't physically go that fast. And so I haven't looked at any of the like recent traffic counts or speed data, but I imagine we're seeing on some of these heavy arterials that are all of a sudden, you know, really quiet, that that issue could arise. And again, that's just another reason why narrowing the roadway, whether it's, you know, a parking protected bike lane or expansion of the sidewalk is always going to be a priority.
That and a total disregard for stop signs. That's my angry old man on a porch rant right now. But it's, I mean, yeah, you're right. It's higher speeds and just there's nothing causing people to stop and there's no enforcement. So why not just run a stop sign? But yes, yeah, those are larger issues. Yeah.
I haven't personally seen that, but that's definitely not good. we definitely rely on the stop sign quite a bit. I think there's a lot of opportunity, but we also need to recognize that just because volumes are reduced, we can't expect that we'll return to the normal under this current, you know, way it's operating. And there may be opportunities right now to implement projects with reduced friction from maybe like parking demand or other issues, other things. But at the same time, the DOT's budget is going to be very constrained because parking revenues are reduced or sales taxes are reduced, you know, things that implement that provide the budget for these very expensive infrastructure projects are certainly going to be challenged.
Right. Well put. I think that's a good point. Just around revenues and, you know, even your point around $200,000 to close streets, there's going to be a lot of cost benefit analysis going on, and it's going to be very interesting to see how much of a movement towards, you know, privatization within a transportation system happens. And hopefully there are more partnerships, which I think we'll probably get into a little more next.
So, and that kind of does, it feeds really well into the next question I had, which was, you know, we saw you guys had a really interesting kind of arrangement and partnership in Portland that mm-hmm. was, it was kind of framed as almost subsidies, but in reality it was, we'll stop charging you fees and you guys will do a discount. We'd love to hear about that, but also just in the broader picture of, you know, there seems to be a slight shift in tone and kind of approach as far as cities now seeing micromobility when done well and responsibly as something that's going to be really important, less comfortable on a packed train or bus. And if you want to avoid kind of a Carmageddon, this is a very, you know, useful and helpful kind of third way. Are you seeing, is Portland, is that partnership model the harbinger of things to come? Or are we going to start seeing, you know, some cities charge very large fees?
yep.
Very low, you know, it's very, very like, let's see how much I can get from, you know. So I'm curious your thoughts on what does COVID mean? You know, I obviously some of these are policy changes that, you know, that all of the operators would have probably liked to see or anyways. But do you think that the kind of this COVID situation and the particularly its impact on transit alters the conversation in the next few RFPs that start to come out?
Yeah. I mean, I think we also need to be honest that like we did it to ourselves, right? I mean, the one vendor in particular kind of entered the market with a campaign that they would offer every city $1 per scooter per day. And from, you know, the onset of their, you know, entry into markets, and we're still undoing some of the precedent that set. And I'm still just reminded by that, by working with my team every day on, you know, trying to influence sustainable and practical, but also good policy at our markets, and continuing to see this dollar per scooter per day fee come in. I'm like, oh God, again, it's still there. So, you know, the fee conversation is certainly, I think, being revisited. Why is that like really being challenged right now? Well, I think the experience we just had, where every city, every state, county, and or city was just challenged by their government to say, figure out what's essential and what's not. Basically, make a determination: should this, you know, sector of the of a business industry, or should this transportation resource, or should this, you know, service that the city government offers, should they stay open, should they shut down during COVID? And mm-hmm. pretty much the resounding echo from cities was micromobility is essential. And that's really important to put us, you know, set us in stone as part of the transportation fabric. And especially at a time when, you know, like I said previously, transit can't really be relied upon as it normally is, as the fallback for our transportation network, if you maybe can't own and maintain a personal vehicle or you know, or have other mobility challenges, and you maybe have, can't get into an Uber because you need a wheelchair or something like that. So micromobility being an option for some folks, not all folks, was deemed as essential. And Spin was able to stay live and operational in many markets throughout the crisis, Portland being one of them. And we quickly just worked with the city to say, listen, we want to offer this to as many people as we can. We want to redesign our deployment plan to address transportation gaps in your transit network, basically deployments focused on hospitals, on grocery stores, pharmacies, places where we know people are going to still need to get around. And kind of developing this model where we would continue to operate expecting, you know, significant reductions in demand, we worked with the city to basically reduce our fees, like you said, to then offer the customer a lower price product in addition to our Everyday Heroes offering, which was basically unlimited free trips under 30 minutes for healthcare employees. So yeah, like just deliberate, like we want to help. We have a resource we can offer. How do we do it? And that's what we resulted in PBOT.
Do you think that's going to stay? That's going to stand though? Like, do you think cities are going to kind of pull it back if we're seeing a little bit of pullback on the investment side too?
I think we're going to continue to see more deliberate public-private partnerships last in that. I think cities are looking more at, you know, single vendor exclusives or one or two vendor markets that allow for more, you know, direct partnership. I mean, the way Denver approached their RFP is very much a nod to that. Like, hey, we can get a lot more out of this partnership if we go with a single vendor and work with them to design the program versus creating like an open competitive market that controls for itself in terms of, you know, competitive pricing and such. So, you know, just a different way of getting to potentially a similar outcome, but definitely one that allows for the, I think, the public agency to guide it there a lot quicker. So that's something that I think we'll see more of as the industry rebounds from COVID.
Okay. And then, all right. So, and then we talked about it a little briefly before the show, but, you know, and we alluded to this earlier, but there's obviously been a lot of big news in terms of consolidation and a kind of forced acquisition almost, you know, of some of this, but with that, of your competitors. And mm-hmm. with that comes a really fascinating question about the transferability of permits. Mm-hmm. And so I'd love to hear your thoughts on, you know, should the permits, the jump permits, particularly in the places where it was a competitive competition and jump, you know, got it and earned it and there wasn't one awarded to Lime, like should jump permits go straight to Lime, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, it's going to really come down to obviously how the permit was written and, you know, legal interpretation of that will be the, you know, I think the actual result of this question. But I think then you also have to ask, like, what was the intent of the permit and the program? And in most cases, one of the kind of in the intents behind this is a fair market, the fact that the city is choosing to go with a limited vendor permit is giving themselves the ability to choose operators that are have a history of compliance, operators that have a history of working with the city and not against the city, operators that are offering a program or a service that they want to bring to their community. And then if the ownership of a fleet or a brand now changes hands, how does the city view that, you know, for implementing that program that was maybe either upcoming or already live? And there's many systems out there where both Jump and Lime were live. And from looking into it, there's a variety of permit language that speak to the transferability of them. So I think we'll see a variety of outcomes. But ultimately, what I hope will come out of this is that cities will look at that element of their permit language, of their whether it's in their ordinance or in the, you know, operating requirements, whatever, they'll look at it with a new kind of scrutiny and really make sure that from this experience, they have the right language that reflects the market that they want to create. So, you know, this is one example. Other mergers and acquisitions will likely happen. So I think it's important that cities look at it with that, you know, future looking, you know, purview as to under what circumstances would we allow this to happen? Is double dipping in a permit okay? Yeah. Can one company acquire a new fleet and do they have to reduce their fleet to one of the permits, you know, caps if it's a cap system? All of these kind of questions will need to be asked, and I think we'll both see near term action taken based off of today's language and changes to the permits language long term.
Excellent.
Great. Well, I know that we're running short on time, but Kyle, this is a fantastic conversation that we could go on for hours longer. And there are so many sort of unanswered questions here that, you know, we hope to have you on again to dig into those some more. So I guess for listening, how can they learn more about what you guys are up to at Spin? Is there a place where they should go to learn more or follow you guys online?
Yep. So we obviously have a website, and I think the best place if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably most interested in our blog. The URL. I would just Google spin blog, and you'll probably find it. That's how I find it. But I think it's actually linked on our website. So go to spin.app, and you'll see the blog link there. We try to continue to kind of share our perspectives and trends we're seeing from data. What's happening during COVID? What's the next partnership that we have brewing up that we want to share with the community? That's the best venue to hear what we're up to. But yeah, we're out there on all the social media channels, and we'll see you at all the conferences once they're allowed to restart.
2025.
Exactly.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, we'll throw the links to those in the show notes and on our website as well. Pete, where can we find you?
You can find me at Catapult Policy on Twitter.
Great. And Greg Rodriguez
at Smarter Transpo on Twitter.
Excellent. And I am at AV Greg R. Follow the Mobility Podcast at Mobility Podcast and check our website, mobilitypodcast.com. Kyle, thanks again for joining us. We look forward to having you on again in the future. And best of luck as we're getting the country moving again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a wonderful conversation, and look forward to the next one.